right, here we are. Welcome back to Book Wave, the book club podcast. If you're new around here, don't forget to check us out around Anchor, YouTube, and our website, www.bookwave.club. I'm Scott, joined by Will.
Hey.
And Synapsion.
Yo, Synapsion here in the Book Wave gang.
All right, and today we're looking at the fifth book in the Old Testament, or the final book of the Torah, Deuteronomy, or known to the Greeks as the Second Law. And this book is also known as a recap of the laws and the Ten Commandments of Moses. And it's been a pretty crazy experience for me, in a way. And I just wanted to open up the podcast by saying that... how has your experience with the Bible altered your view of the Bible itself? And how much experience did you have with it prior to going into it? Let's start with you, Will.
Okay. Hello. Good morning. Going into the Bible, I don't think I read any of the Bible. I think my experience would have been church-based from a bygone age as a child going to, I think, Calvary Baptist Church, maybe. And, you know, I've seen Bible quotes around the countryside, as you probably know, Scott. You
don't John 3:16.
Every day. So I've heard it was a thing. A lot of people took to it, but I was really completely ignorant. And since reading the Torah, which is really cool to say that we've accomplished that, and congratulations, guys! Like, it's
yeah,
been
really.
a sojourn.
Yeah,
it's completely opened up my awareness. Like, I had a closed mind. Literally, I had never picked up the book. In fact, I picked up the Quran before I picked up the Bible. I looked at philosophy and Eastern philosophy specifically a lot more, and gave it a lot more attention and respect just for the very virtue of society today. I think I shamed the book and I judged it by its cover. Oh my God.
Ain't that the truth?
And I'm glad we started this, because it's something I wanted to do for a couple of years now. And
yeah, same.
It's not what I expected in any capacity. It didn't do anything I asked it to, and it didn't talk about the people I thought it was going to talk about. Like, I have been asking so many questions and having so many conversations since starting this book that I'm very thankful for that, because it seems to be that people want to know about it and talk about it, but no one wants to read it, and they're ready to have an opinion about it. And for us, I think the whole intention was, like, my opinion of the Bible 2 months ago is completely different than it is today, and it completely unrecognizable from what it will be in a year. But, like, the opinion of the future is where I'm trying to get to, because I don't think it's fair to judge this book without actually reading it.
Yeah, like, my experience before actually reading it was, you know, commentary from mostly atheists on YouTube, and, like, you know, just the knowledge that things like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, all of this stuff, the inspiration from that came from the Bible. I didn't really familiarize myself too much with the actual content of the Bible, and just kind of had a vague overview understanding of it. And, like, even just the first book changed my complete understanding of everything involved. How about you, Synapsion?
Yeah, my experience has been similar to you guys. You know, I was brought up into a family of Baptists, Southern United States. And it was just expected, you know, you adhere to the will of your parents. And if they said to go to Sunday school or church, that's what you would do. And so you'd hear other people's opinions, snippets here and there. It wasn't really until Dr. Peterson did the psychological perspectives on Genesis that I really started taking a deeper view And when I tell people that, you know, we're doing this bookwave project of the Pentateuch, I kind of get puzzled looks, and I kind of get the impression that most people haven't read the Bible. They just take in the snippets that they get from their pastors or from church, and they just assume, well, you know, that's the parts we need to focus on. But after reading it myself, actually going through reading different translations of it, I've been left pretty shocked, just kind of dismayed. And it's given me an understanding of how people can take an imagined order or an imagined system like the mountain god El Shaddai and use that to justify their current goals or existence. Like we have here Moses telling all his people right before they're about to go into the promised land of Canaan. And the whole justification is, well, this was our covenant with God. It's the promised land given to us. So we're going to go and basically take over.
Yeah, it's it's weird that like it's ingrained in our culture. And so I think that's why I overlooked it for so long, was because it's always been there. Like the Bible, as far as I was concerned, was the backbone of, you know, the Jesuit crusades into the town that I currently live in. I've got a rock 50 meters from where I'm sitting that says this is where Champlain landed. And it's like, wacky. Like, I don't even know how. Pardon?
I mean, the same principle of the promised land, isn't that kind of the basis for the idea of America, and you know, we're a nation created by God?
Yeah, it's this, we have a very weird relationship with religion and God, and I don't think it's appropriate, because we have just kind of jumped in bed with him and said that we're going to use him to take over the world. And now we're living in this sort of post-colonial society that's saying, you know, none of our grandparents even were colonizers. You know, like this is ancient history to us now. And yet it's still so prevalent and there's so much controversy around it. It's so hard to unpack it. And as soon as you open the lid on that bottle, it's just like, oh, this is a bottle full of bottles.
Yeah, that fits into the, like, Ben Shapiro point that he makes, that our society is like basically descended from Jerusalem and Athens, like the two major cities that gave birth to our culture. Just kind of started with, you know, absolute adherence to God and all that stuff, and then science and reason with Plato and Socrates, and two of them stuck Aristotle. Together. Yeah, Aristotle. Can't forget him. And Alexander.
What I've also...
Was that Synapsian?
What I also... I found interesting how the Old Testament has mirrored other writings that came before it. Like the... Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just kind of a recapitulation of older ideas that has been revised and redacted to fit the narrative of this original group, the Israelites, who they wanted their own land, basically.
Yeah, we could go on and on about like all of the previous mythologies. Like Hammurabi's tablets were before the Ten Commandments, and where did Abraham come from? Well, like Ur of the Chaldees, that's where Babylon was. So, you know, he probably brought his ideas from the Far East, brought it to Egypt, his people got enslaved, and then they, I don't know. It's basically all a metaphor, but you can see how culture can shift through the ages. Like the flood myth occurs 9 times, like everywhere. Like Utnapishtim is Noah, basically, from the old Sumerian or Mesopotamian mythologies. It's the exact same story. Took all the animals onto his ark. Thanos.
Right. So how much experience do you have with those older texts, Scott? Because you sound well versed, but are you getting this from the compendium or companion book, rather, from Dr. Isaac Asimov?
Yes, some of it comes from there for sure, but a lot of it I just remember from like some of the history classes that I took in high school. Like I've always just been interested in ancient history in general, so like when I read books for fun, it's about Norse mythology or the conquering of Gaul by Gaius Julius Caesar.
Right.
We've been learning
And you're learning
Latin.
Latin. But you're doing something really cool, which is twice as much work as what we're doing, which is you're reading the Bible and you're reading annotations by a genius.
Yeah, a guy that's
And it's
written over 600 books in his life.
just ridiculous. I actually have a German copy of Letters Between Sigmund Freud and Albert Einstein with an opening essay by Dr. Isaac Asimov. So that was a cool thing that my dad pulled out of a box last week. And it's interesting because last week, before I started the John Vervaeke series, I'm going tangential here for 2 seconds.
Oh, let's get right into it.
He shows me this book and he translates this. Well, first he makes me read German, and I did all right, but I don't know what I was reading. So he translates it and he says the first sentence is something like, there's enough work, resources, and some other third thing. If we distributed the wealth of the world equally, everybody would be fine. There'd be no need for any of us to be slaves. And so I think the book is called Why War, essentially. And it's these essays, but are letters between Sigmund Freud and Albert Einstein. So I'm going to have to learn German and read it because it seems interesting. But then John Vervaeke says that there's this time before evolution of like 800,000 years where resources were so abundant that there was no necessity to evolve. And it just kind of had me thinking about, the sort of weird state we're in where we do have access to harvest all of the resources in abundance, but we don't all have distribution of money to buy into those resources. And so we're forced to evolve.
That kind of goes hand in hand with like population growth, and if there's not enough people to demand more from the environment, then there's not going to be any need to evolve because you can't spread your genes fast enough to require evolution. You're just good enough doing the same thing over and over again. That's why
Which is
some species evolve and some don't. Some stay the same for millions of years because they're perfectly content building anthills and worshiping their queen.
and evidently in Egypt, resources weren't that abundant, and there was the need for war and conquest, and that sort of gets recapitulated through Deuteronomy, which was draws it out, and I respect it because they do a great job of putting a lot of data onto a page, but the amount of repetition and redundancy in the writing styles, like it makes sense because like if you're descendant from the guy who in section 316 is the son of such, who's the son of such, who's the son of such, and this guy did this with this spear over to here, like you'd want to know that story. But for someone reading it not for the history of the minor details, it gets cumbersome, I find. And that's probably one of the barriers to reading a book like this. Like there's Bibles that are translated just to have normal English in them, to get rid of the thous and thens and thuses and suches. And then there's probably annotated Bibles that completely strip tons of sections and say this is irrelevant, and that's probably not a good thing to do.
Yeah, and like
Right. I remember in Bible school, we kind of had comic versions of the Bible or like pictorial Bibles.
right.
And then you actually go back and read the text, and it kind of, I think what you were talking about is the documentary style of the Bible. It's written in a documentary kind of fashion. The documentary hypothesis that
All right.
the reason we saw certain similar styles of writing throughout the Old Testament was because we had this Deuteronomists or a group of people known as the revisionists or the redactors who went back and edited. They added things like the first chapter of Genesis and parts of Exodus and multiple places in the Old Testament where it was redacted and added after the fact by these Deuteronomists sometimes around maybe BC 750 BCE
or that's what
era of King Josiah.
Yeah, Isaac Asimov talks a lot about that too, about like the original two documents that they found, like the J document and the E document, and how they were kind of collaborated together along with this new priestly document that was the like authoritative text at the time that had just evolved, and they were integrating it with some of the older stories. So you can like go through some versions of the Bible that are like highlighted, and like this part of Genesis is from the E document, this part is from the J document, and like a big part of that explains why like some verses refer to gods and Elohim and others refer to Yahweh or just Lord, because like it was the two different tribes had their two different traditions. So like the Ephraim tribe had the E document, and the Judite tribe had the J document.
Right. And to riff off that, the Deuteronomists, called the D's, they wanted this model of a singular God. You know, they believed at the time that there were multiple gods, but they wanted to consolidate all that power into Yahweh or El Shaddai. And I think previously that god was called Elohim, who was part of like a pantheon. And this all came from the earlier ideas of Babylonia, the god Baal, which I believe Moses caught the Israelites creating like a gold calf or something. In the
I think that was
Baal.
Moloch. Was that Moloch?
Well, was Moloch. Moloch refers to the Canaanite god Baal. Moloch is kind of like the king of shame. That's what it means. That's a reference to Baal himself.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And Baal was just one of the gods. I think he was the god of fertility and weather. And in that pantheon, there were...
He was like the chief god. He was basically the Zeus of the Canaanite religion. So, like, him controlling nature is basically the same as, you know, Zeus's power over nature and Odin's power over nature kind of thing.
There was another god I had heard about, Elion, which I think translates to the Most High God. And I found that kind of interestingly similar to El Shaddai, which is called the mountain god, because you know, a mountain is something that's high. So they kind of replace El Elyon from the Babylonian mythology with this El Shaddai, which is then later referred to as Yahweh. It's redacted in there that Yahweh is the one god. And I believe even in the Ten Commandments is the first commandment that says, "You shall worship no other gods but me."
Yeah.
And so essentially he's acknowledging that the people believe in other gods, and there are other gods. And eventually, I think later in, not sure exactly where in the revisionist story, those other gods kind of get demoted maybe to what we would refer to as angels.
Yeah.
But they're still there.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, when they came up with angels, they were just trying to make the text work with their own monotheistic ideology. Like, I can't see anything in the Bible itself that tells me there's only one God, or that any of the people of the Old Testament believe that there was only one God, and that in fact, the conclusion they came to was that there's only one God worth worshiping, and that was Yahweh.
Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, the beginning of Deuteronomy starts where they're about to go into Canaan, and the Canaanites are known to believe in multiple gods. They're polytheistic.
Yes.
Right. And so, like, what's frustrating for me about all of this is, like, when we talk about how has our perspective changed, like, at the beginning, I was like, okay, the Bible, this is like the backstory. This is like ancient stuff. And then I have you two guys, and you're giving me the backstory of the backstory. And it's like, it just doesn't stop. Like, oh, yeah, God, let's find out about him. And you guys are just like, oh, God? Don't you mean gods? Don't you mean more ancienter?
Yeah.
And it's just like, there's so much, because it's like, I want to get to the start of it all. Like,
Yeah, you're never gonna get to the start. And
no. I don't think.
there's lots of like scientific writers that make the case that that's just natural human progression, that we start off with animistic religion, then shamanistic, then polytheistic, then monotheistic, and then of course on the end they tack on a worldview based on science and reason and propagating our genes and survival and well-being and so on and so forth.
Don't think they know
It's
what
kind of a
happens next.
strange loop. No matter where you start, if you progress like the Ouroboros, you're going to end up back in the same place. And it seems like the technological revolution, they've replaced this idea of God with reason and logic.
Yeah. And that's what a Christian would call Satan, the adversary.
I would make the argument that no one has done a very good job of replacing God yet.
I would agree with that.
And there may be some pretenders out there who think and live lives as though, there is already an answer and we don't need to do any more reading. And if everybody would just shut up and listen to them, that the world would be a better place. And I don't think that's right either, because if it was the answer, we'd probably have all have come to the same conclusion.
Yeah. Like I could be wrong, but I think Nietzsche thought he had the answer. Like he presented a worldview that like you don't need God, you can become an Übermensch all on your own. And then he went insane. And
Yeah.
he wasn't an Übermensch for very long if he ever made it there. I can tell you that much.
And it's just like these, it's the longevity of ideas and philosophies. And right now, I think we're kind of in a time period where I would argue, at least for the 26 years I've been alive, or even just the 20 years I've been cognizant, we've had fads and just so many fads. And there's a very big space for people to try and give the answer and for people to come and form a community around what they think to be the answer. And prior to my existence, I think that space was a lot more dangerous. And I think we see that a lot with the cults. And well, anybody can research that if they'd like to. But it'd be nice to see something ambitious, or maybe not even ambitious, but aspirational, that tries to just throw a blanket over the whole planet and say, forget about God. Let's think about humans. And not to say God's dead or not to say God's relevant, but to say just put them aside for 2 seconds and realize that we're all the same species.
Yeah.
We're kind of in this middle territory between these old ideas of these gods and these newer ideas of creating an ideal at the top of the pyramid, whether that be reason or something. But right now we're in that middle area where we're still divided to all these separate groups. And yeah, I think the highest ideal would be to actually come together as a planet to do
I
something.
think I want to pick apart your pyramid metaphor because, like, if I were to picture where I'd like to see the top of the pyramid land, it would be actually on an equal playing field where all of the old and new ideas are in this spectrum that's on this line, and we pick up this line and we set it over here, and then we say, okay, but this is what it means to be a human. You can go over there, you can do whatever you want over there, but at the core of it, here's what it means to be a human, and here's what we're all going to agree upon. And you have to take this over there. Anything over there that contradicts with this doesn't work anymore. And it's not because that's bad or that's wrong. It's because this is an orange, and that is an apple.
Mm-hmm.
If you could somehow time travel back to like the time of Moses, I mean, isn't that essentially what he was saying to these people in the story? Like, this is the new law. We have the Deuteronomic code, and it's, you know, 365 negative things you can't do, and I think 249 positive things you can do, and this is the way it's going to be.
The only thing to say about that is with 613 rules, everybody is going to be a sinner. Like, there's no way around that.
Yeah. And that's the problem when you get into like the murky territory of well-defined objective rules.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are philosophical, emotional, belief-based, weird, logical creatures that, you know, before you get to logic, you have to get through all that other stuff. And exactly what you said, Synapsian. Like, Moses said, we need to stop sacrificing humans to these false gods. We need to get together and stop washing our hands in water that have dead bats in them. We need to, like, do some really basic stuff, and we all need to start doing it, because all of this is necessary to perpetuate our species. And it was a very conquest-driven perpetuation, but I think it did well for at least 2,000 years.
Yeah, just looking at history, though, as cultures try to integrate with themselves, like in the time of Moses, when the Israelites were, like, coexisting with the Egyptians and the Canaanites, that only led to war. And in the time of Rome, when, you know, it was the upstart Christians trying to coexist with the Romans, it only led to war. And, you know, the Crusades and all that stuff, and holy expansion and all that stuff. So how do we reconcile the two halves of society today? Like, just to take a random example, like the SJWs with, you know, hashtag trad life,
or the typical random example.
Just like a random conservative and an SJW, how do they reconcile without, you know, the same way that we've reconciled in the past? Like, how do we find the way out here?
I think they could, like, smoke a joint together and re-realize the mysterious together. I don't know.
No, I think they'd probably have to go harder than the joint. I think we might be requiring eucalyptus leaves for that sort of symbiosis. But that's the scary thing, isn't it? That, you know, when you look at the historical record, the new normal requires the destruction of the old system, and the old system... Yeah. Is this perfectly balanced system that is quite happy being stabilized by all of its sort of secrets and shadows and negligences. Yeah. And it resists change. And when you come across a wall.
Yeah,
I'd like to believe. Hold on, I'd like to believe that if the SJW and the conservative walk into the bar and some third existential element enters into the bar, the SJW and the conservative sort of strip that label and become humans. But I don't know what that existential entity is, and I don't know how to get them to look up.
Yeah, and one of the biggest problems there is it's a lot deeper than just getting the individual to reconcile with the individual. It's the mob with the other mob. Like, if you look at Trump derangement syndrome on both ends, he's either Orange Man bad or he's the patron saint of America. Like, it's hard to find the middle ground there. And without the middle ground as, like, this kind of referee, how do we, you know, get these people to stop being at each other's throats?
The other factor, too, is, like, what we're seeing on the news, well, we're not seeing much of it anymore, but these mobs that are surging up, I don't know if they're aware, but there's other mobs. Like, once you enter the space and say, I am a mobster, the individuals And the groups and parties that also wear that hat say, welcome to a very long and infinite game. We have many more resources and tools and experience than you do. We're going to sit back. You get as far as you can in this thing that you think you're playing, that we've been playing this whole time. And if you succeed, we'll squash you. And it's just like, it's a short-sighted philosophy to say that you're a mob. I can't abide by that. Ugh.
Is that not what the Israelites are doing, essentially, in this story, though? They're considering,
if you want to be a mob, you got to be the best mob.
Yeah, you got to be the mountain gods.
Yeah, like, there's one way to do it, and that's united under one banner and with 5 million soldiers. And that's not what I'm seeing in town squares. What are they playing at?
Yeah. Right, the mobs we see today are kind of fractionalized. They might start as one group and then end up like the LGBTQ plus.
So last weekend we moved my brother-in-law and mother-in-law and my other brother-in-law down to their house in a Mennonite village. Like, not in a Mennonite village, because obviously that's not, you're not getting a house there and you don't know where it is. But that's sort of my point, is like, you look at the Mennonites and it's intimidating. That's the word everybody agreed was what it was that you felt, is you see this man. It's not even a person, it's a man. And you know he's a man. And you know that he's a man in the sense that man used to mean man. And all of them are like that. And they all know what to wear. They all know what to do. They all know where to go. They all know who they are. And a dog is just a dog. And you have this group of people who have convictions and consistency. And they have been able to do quite well.
But Will, that's an oppressive social construct. Don't you know anything about the patriarchy?
Right. But let's not say the Mennonites are the goal. But the reality is that they exist. And they've been existing. And through, you know, consistency and similar convictions. Like, all of them are doing the same thing everywhere. And like, so he comes to the house, there's some broken glass, he immediately cleans up the broken glass, because you have to deal with that immediately. And this is not the mentality that I see people carrying. I don't see people who know who they are and also know what they're doing and also know why they're doing it and how it's going to get done and where it's going to go. I just see people freaking out, and it's sad.
Yeah, and what I really admire about the Mennonites and the Amish is that they're very live and let live, like kind of a libertarian structure. Like, they're just doing their thing. They're not going to try to impose their religion or their way of life on you. They're not going to knock on your door and ask you if you've heard the word of the good Lord. So
it's even more than that. If you ask them, if you ask a Mennonite about their philosophy or even about their clothing or anything that they do, it's usually, I don't know, or that's just the way it's always been. That's just the way it is, because they're not trying to have a conversation with you, and they're not trying to tell you about their beliefs, because they have their people. They have enough people. Yeah. And we're back.
All right.
Rugmo, I'm curious, since you've studied some of this stuff in more detail, like the mythologies, I'm wondering what your perspective is. Like, what are the Canaanites in this Deuteronomy story think of these Israelites, like, waiting outside across the river? And, you know, did they think that they were about to get, like, beat down? Or,
yeah, well, we don't really have much, like, surviving evidence from the Canaanites. There's, like, a little bit of, like, art and stuff from the Hittite Empire, which was kind of, like, at war with the Egyptians near the end of the Bronze Age when the Sea Peoples attacked. But, like, not much specifically on the Canaanites other than their religion. But it is based a lot, or it looks a lot like the Mesopotamian religions, the Norse religions, and some of the other Proto-Indo-European style cultures. And the most interesting thing that I came across when I really dug into it was the phenomenon of the Nephilim, because there's a lot of different translation, like transformations for this word Nephilim. Because when the Hebrews talked about them, it was like strictly talking about like the fallen ones. They were talking about people of a bygone age that are all dead, like pre-flood times. Like the Nephilim were these great warriors, and it could be taken in a number of different ways. Like it was a different species of giants, or it was like referring to the heroes, like the Greek heroes in like the Iliad or the Odyssey, like when it refers to Achilles as an old hero, they would like use the word Nephilim to be like they were, it was a giant of their time. And it was kind of like, it kind of really reminded me of when I was reading through the Game of Thrones books, and I was talking about like the hero's age, the age of heroes before like the modern age, and I was talking about how instead of like the gods that they all rallied behind, it was like a polytheistic culture. They were all like in Game of Thrones anyway, it was like a polytheistic culture. All of the trees represented a god. That's how like they interacted with them. None of the gods had names, and history revolved around these heroes around Westeros kind of thing. So that was like an analyzation of history where it was kind of like the same thing when it talks about Thor. Actually, in the beginning of the Prose Edda, this is another point, it basically starts off with the Christian creation myth, and then it goes on to say that like man forgot about Adam and Eve and the one true God and separated into all of these tribes, and one of these tribes settled in Troy, and then after Troy fell, the survivors took off, migrated north. And they were the original Aesir. They were the heroes. They were the gods that came up north and spread their own culture and technology and religion to the Germanic peoples and the Norsemen. So, like, the more I look into it, the deeper it gets, and the more I think the Nephilim is just referring to people that held the same status as someone like Achilles or Hector in the Iliad. So, like another example from the Bible, like David versus Goliath, it could have just been Goliath was probably a big dude because, you know, they didn't have jiu-jitsu back then, so chances are the biggest guy was gonna win. So they put forth their Goliath to fight, you know, the best of the Israelites, little David with his hand sling. And yeah, I did have one conversation with a friend of mine who made the case that Goliath was a giant in like the literal sense that he had giantism, and he was, you know, he suffered from nearsightedness and slow movement and poor blood circulation and all the other things. And apparently there's a line where he confronts David and says, "Oh, you approach me with two sticks," when he was only holding one stick, so he was like seeing double. So that could be evidence that he was just a nearsighted abnormality who they propped up as a hero in the same way that the Trojans would prop up Hector, the
Your science
Canaanites.
sounds ruthless, sir.
It
I think
could
your
be
friend
that
saw
he was
the
just a
same.
nearsighted abnormality.
There was a TED talk on that very subject. I wonder if your friend saw that TED talk.
Oh, probably, honestly.
It's weird because, like, there's only so far we can find out about all of these stories, and we have to just read what we can and
Yeah.
hope that, you know, we find artifacts and stuff, then maybe some secret cave has actually a whole bunch more scrolls that turn up in another 20 years. That's always fun, and it's interesting because it's our own backstory, even if it has nothing to do with us. You know, the human race did stuff, and we have a record of it, and it's super cool and fun and interesting. And then also humbling to find out that, you know, we've got the same problems we did 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, and to think, like, what human beings are capable of in the horrible and in the fantastical sense. Like, look at the incredible feat that Moses did, taking out these people from slavery into, like, the masters of their own country up north, the land of plenty, where the grapes grew like crazy.
Yeah.
There's enough olive oil for everybody to go around.
Well, I was kind of interested on what your perspectives were regarding, like, why are there so many curses compared to the number of blessings? The actual code is somewhere, I think it starts around chapter 12, but then around chapter 26.
Right after
26, they list the various blessings that you would enjoy if you followed the code, and then that's followed directly by the number of curses that you would have to endure if you didn't follow the code. And I just thought it was kind of interesting that there were more curses than blessings.
I think it comes down to two things. One was that is just part of Moses's theology and ideology that making people fear God would be a better incentive than to just say, hey, you get all these rewards if you do the right thing. Because then they would do all the right things, and then as soon as the blessings didn't happen, they would get upset and say, well, you're also a sinner, so obviously he's not going to bless you like that if you've got this sin too. Just a way of, like, you know, covering all of his bases. So, like,
yeah,
well, if you're, it's like, you can't just have a good thing and then expect a good thing. It's not like pure karma like that. You have to live it embodiment. You have to live it and embody it to the fullest extent, or nothing happens and God hates you.
I think you're on the right thread, and I think you're hitting on the same thing that I want to say. But
it's also a form of oppression, just to make people scared all the time and obedient.
But it's my turn. It's my turn. I think as far as your former latter point goes, it makes it really convenient to be in the position where if someone goes to say, well, I did everything that I was supposed to, why didn't I get my blessing? To be able to say, oh, well, you're wearing jeans, that's why. Like, the amount of rules, like, you're wearing jeans with a cotton top, like, you can't do that, and that's why you didn't get your rain today like you asked for. It makes it very easy to just sort of brush people away when you have that many rules. You can always find a reason that things didn't go your way, as opposed to just having good blessings for doing the good stuff. And you're also coming in on the heels of a bunch of gods that would have you sacrifice your child to get what you wanted, and necessitate the sacrifice of children to get what you wanted, and then for things to still not go well. So I think everybody that was in a position to make this sort of work would know that while good incentives are good, having an internalized bad thing to avoid is a lot easier to motivate humans, especially at that time. Like, you can make all of the good promises, but it's in your brain, that's all crap. That doesn't mean anything. But if you have a very real threat to avoid, and you're forced to memorize what all of those threats are, and every week you're reminded what those threats are, and every time you do something wrong, you're reminded of a particular threat, it's very encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate goal of all this is to adhere to those commandments. And you got the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and you got the Deuteronomy Code. It's all a way to walk in grace with God, if you will. And I think they meant that to be difficult. It's kind of like the idea of perfection. In order to be perfect, it's really difficult. And you have to have some sort of motivational force to push you along.
I think it's like if you had a really stubborn child and you're its father and you're a tyrannical psychopath, given enough time, money, and resources, you could create this system and call it religion, wherein what you're trying to do is get the child to do what you want the way you want it to. And if they don't, you'll do all of these bad things. But if they do what you want them to do, you'll reward them, because all you want them to do is what you think is best for them. And if you have the power to put that system in place, this is just tyranny on a mass scale and enforced brainwashing to perpetuate the human race, because they're too stubborn to figure out that you do have the answers. And it was quite successful, so there might be some merit to it.
If I'm hearing you right, it sounds like you want them to voluntarily walk this way. And
yeah.
There's this quote I read by Thomas Jefferson, which said, you can put a harness on a horse, but you can't put a harness on a man unless they volunteer.
Right. I have a similar quote, which is, you can take a horse to water, and if you're strong enough, you can drown them. And that's sort of the way I feel about human stubbornness. You cannot make it take that drink. And we do need to figure out how to get these horses to want to drink water and wear a harness. Because, like, come on!
Yeah, there was one of the codes, I think it was chapter 21 in Deuteronomy. They're talking about dealing with gluttonous and disobedient children. And the last resort to deal with them is essentially stoning them to death, you know, the death penalty. But
yeah,
it seems like they reached that point a little quickly, though. Oh, they don't listen? What? Try this. That doesn't work. Stone them to death.
It's indicative of their level of awareness of the subconscious. Like, they know that there's gut feelings at this point. You know what I mean? They know what shame is. They know what fear is. They know what dread is. And they know how to encourage people in those capacities. But they don't understand that there are reactions and there are outlashes that look like something but represent something entirely different. And that, in fact, all of humans are constantly reacting from a place of good intention, but by the time it gets out of them with their beliefs, their behaviors, their learned cultural understandings of what it means to be a human and what they think they're telling themselves and what they think other people think about themselves, you get, you know, humans as we see them today. But, like, that doesn't mean you should stone them. It would work. Yeah. You've got a whole bunch of lemons. They're doing the wrong philosophy. Stone them. Try again. It doesn't take long to make babies, but I don't know if it's necessary anymore.
Yeah, the other thing that I feel like we have to consider is that, like, that's what the law says, you know, stone your children. But how often did they actually stone their children? With a law like stone your children, those kids are probably going to behave themselves.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, I think it was a last resort, but like you said, they got there occasionally. But throughout the Old Testament, Israel itself is kind of viewed as a disobedient child. That's the whole reason they had to write it in this documentary way, you know, listing all these curses.
That brings me to
Moses,
another. Or sorry,
Moses
what were you
never
say?
Believed they were like he thought like they were just gonna disobey, and I think he probably was just like, oh, these. They're going to do it again. I left them for 40 days. They were making cows out of gold. They're like, here's another 100 rules. Is that enough? No, here, have 300 more rules. Is that enough? You're still going to screw it up. I'm just going to die on this hill.
I want to shove that cow down your mouth. That's what he did. He ground it up. and made him eat it like a kid if he cursed, and the mom's like gonna, you know, put soap in their mouth.
Yeah, wash his mouth out with molten calf.
Well, and our equivalent to childhood stoning is calling the police, right? Or not even CAS, it's the police. You remember being threatened at 6 years old that they're going to call the police? And you're like, oh, not the police! They're going to arrest me, a six-year-old, for misbehaving. Oh.
Yeah, but that's juvenile another huge detention. Point. That's another huge point, too, because back in the day, it was the people that were angry at the kid, you know, stoning him. Nowadays, we're like, oh, we got to go get someone else to go do it who has no emotional connection, who's, you know, whatever.
But, yeah, and we're starting to realize we need to do that and come up with systems to suppress that sort of emotional confrontation between individuals. Yeah. But
it's easy to say, it's easy to call 911 and say this guy's causing me problems. It's a lot harder to settle that problem yourself, which is what we need to do more of.
Yeah, but the problem is, the problem is that there's so much that goes on before you talk to a human being that prevents you from talking to a human being. And for me, like, you know, like if you have an issue with someone in your apartment building and you live in an apartment building that rents 20% of its apartments to the local government for subsidizing housing, and you have this variation of long-term care units and geared to income units and welfare units and then regular units, and you've got this problem with someone down the hall, you've never seen them before in your life, everybody's on shift work and different times of leaving, who knows who's behind that door? And that's one of the things, that it's this great blessing and this curse that we're able to live with strangers and so many strangers because of the cultures and cultural rituals and practices that we've developed. But now,
yeah, they didn't have that in the Bronze Age.
No, we've got so many walls that they're starting to manifest inside of our heads. And chances are the person behind that door, no matter what they look like, is a human being who wants to resolve it compassionately.
Yeah.
And that's we've come a long way since Canaan.
Yeah. Another thing I found interesting is the parallel between these the codes of the old days, the Deuteronomic Code and the Ten Commandments, and our own modern legal system, how we have administrative law and criminal law, where the administrative law is typically written in the positive tense. You know, you will do these minimum things, whereas the criminal code is written in a negative sense. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not do drugs and things like that.
Right.
But we've essentially taken, you know, our current system from these older, like the Hammurabi's code and these codes written in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to have some kind of centralized system like that in place, because if you decentralize it and let everybody come up with their own, you know, personal codes of the world, you're going to end up in a chaotic mess. I mean, sure, most people will base their code on like keeping themselves from getting hurt and keeping other people from getting hurt, but you have a small minority who just don't think like that. They think pathologically, like the Virginia Tech mass murderer, you know, just said, well, I'm going to take things into my own hands and start shooting people. And he actually came from a Christian family. I believe his mother took him to church or to see some kind of priest to help him out with his depression. But, you know, you let some people create their own code and it ends up a pathological system, chaotic system.
Yeah, I have nothing against developing your own code, but I think you need a starting point first. Like, start with Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life. You know, then read a bit of the Bible. Then, you know, research some history.
Study some chivalry.
Yeah. But
you know, like, there's some some real basic stuff that I think everybody's been kind of applying for a very long time. Like, you know, if you make a promise, follow through with it. And stuff that's really simple. But when you start coming up with this like pathological system where it's like I'm superior and I am better and I am more capable and I can bend other people's rules, and you start to say that your rules supersede those that are already in place, that's when we have a problem. And it's like what I want to see is a background rule set, not a foreground rule set. Like the United Nations says that water is a basic human right. That doesn't do anything for us. And so then you get into this murky realm of enforcement. And it's like, so we want people to be good, and we want people to do good, and we want people to be able to do whatever they want while being good and doing good. But without a system to enforce that, you're stuck with horses standing beside troughs, and then you get people trying to drown horses because there's not enough sheriffs. And then if you get too many sheriffs, it's a whole other problem. And it's like what can you do when you have to deal with people?
Who is John Galt, right?
All day.
And our current system is based off this Deuteronomic code where there are, a bunch of curses out there where, if you do this, you're going to go to jail or juvenile detention, or you're going to be placed in handcuffs.
Yeah, on
So,
that
was
point,
it?
there was a weird point in this book where it said that, you know, there was like a special prison city in the country of Israel, and like they were sent there, but they could like run away to the next city and be free. Like, I
But
don't
if you
get it.
die, if you get caught before you get there by the person that was related to the person you killed, they could kill you and it wouldn't count as a crime.
Yeah,
Yeah, that was a weird one.
there was a lot of weird little murder rules that didn't make much sense to me. Like, basically saying if you're good enough to run away, then you're absolved of your crimes.
And I think that's probably a tip of the hat to the systems that they couldn't break.
Yeah.
Where it's like, this is how we deal with criminals,
That's
and we're gonna keep dealing with them like this.
what like most of the Bible is, in my opinion, just Moses saying, well, this is how the world works. Must be a God doing all this stuff. I don't know any other way. Or I better tell all these guys that there's a conscious being doing this. But
Yeah.
that brings me to a point that I wanted to bring up with like the notion in today's society anyway about killing our fathers, like killing the image of our fathers, where at least as like young men, we like grow up and we have like, if not our father, like some kind of idol or hero that we emulate. And at some point, like most people will recognize a moment where they saw their hero as an infallible human being. And I think that's a really important point of growing up and maturing. And I think it's a big part of what Christianity inhibits. It keeps us from growing up and realizing our potential by keeping God the Father alive, oppressing us, this completely perfect, omnipotent, omniscient being that can do no wrong. He is your father and he is judging you. And I think that's a huge restriction on us as a human being. So, what do you think about that?
I think it has the capacity to be it, and I can see why it would be in a lot of circumstances, but I would almost argue the Christian argument, which is that no, God wants the best for you. He loves you so much, and he made you perfect and prepared to do everything you're capable of doing.
Well, that's not to say your father didn't either, but you know, he also maybe he smokes, drinks, doesn't fucking exercise. He's an imperfect creature. And when you put this God on a pedestal as this perfect creature, and then you read the Bible and saw how he massacred children, what do you do with that? That's what leads a lot of people to atheism, is that dynamic right there, is this God's perfect. And if that's what you believe, then I can't believe the same thing because.
I would say that anybody who abandons Christianity when they discover their God and their father is fallible and has a storied
history.
That's
not what I'm saying. If we admitted God was fallible, I wouldn't have a problem with it. But it's the lie that we tell ourselves that, like, God is this perfect thing. He has your best intentions, but he also kills people. Like, those two things don't, like...
Kills or killed?
Well, like, just the...
He directs people to kill.
Yeah, like, you can read the Bible and see God as a human, as far as I'm concerned, a product of human ideology that is not infallible by any means. And as soon as you tell as soon as the Catholic Church says, like, God is perfect, God is almighty, God is love, God is everything we should strive to be, and then you read the Bible, and not only is it inconsistent with his laws and rules throughout the Old Testament and the New, but it seems that everybody disagrees about what he is, so that is part of the evidence that God is just an image that we've created.
Well, so, like, I'm just gonna stay on the side of Christianity for a minute and pretend God exists. Like, I think it was short-sighted of the church to say that anything more than God is. Right? The minute they started saying God is perfect, like, they started measuring something that created them. Like, we don't have the tools or the capacities to say God is perfect. Anybody who makes the claim that they know what God is beyond God is selling a lie. And
that's the agnostic point of view.
It's a shame they went that hard, because that puts them into a corner, and it's gonna be a really gross fight from that corner. And, like, I'll tell you right now, God is. If he is, he is. And he wasn't great because he was a product of humanity. And I don't know if it's a chicken and the egg situation, but it feels a lot like it. And he's been growing. And I think he's been out of the scene for a while now. And I'm hoping that he comes back with a sequel that's worth buying the ticket to.
I mean, it's better than nihilism, right?
I'll go with agnosticism every day of the week.
Yeah. Again, we could talk about...
I find myself falling into the agnostic perspective.
Yeah, again, we could talk about our disagreements on what the terms agnostic and atheism actually mean, if you want to get into that.
Well, I'll just
say this. We've had this argument off air where, you know, I say, you're actually an atheist, and you say, well, no, you're actually an agnostic.
Like, I firmly believe that I probably don't think that God exists.
Then you're an atheist. If you don't believe, full stop, you're an atheist. You are
but
without
I don't,
God.
I don't full stop don't believe. I definitely don't. I think I turned off the part of me that asks those questions and just sort of flicked the one lever that says hope for the best and the other one that says expect the worst and figure out the spirituality bit later, because, like I said, chicken or the egg, like, did humans come up with God or did God come up with humans? And if God is, I don't have the metrics to tell you how big he is and how long he is and when he was and when he isn't and any of that. And if he isn't, then fuck.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to believe that there's a God, not necessarily the Christian God. You know, after reading the Bible, you realize he himself calls himself angry, a passionate God. So somebody that's
we can go back to
quickly
our,
move.
We can go back to our original point that we started with when, like, how is our view of the Bible changed? Well, I learned that Yahweh is the God of jealousy. Those words keep popping up in the Bible over and over again. The God of jealousy, the jealous God. So like when I read about Aphrodite being, you know, the god of beauty, how is it not the same thing? And that ties into another Mesopotamian story where, you know, Synapsian touched on this earlier, where El, the Most High, gave birth to all of the other gods that we know, like all of the other gods that became chief deities. Like Zeus was one of his 70 children. Yahweh was one of his 70 children. Osiris, Marduk were each of his children. And they gave the lands to all those people, and they each, you know, gained a different attribute. So if Yahweh was just, you know, the youngest of his 70 brothers and sisters, and he was the jealous god, he had the most incentive to go out and eliminate all the other gods because he was literally just jealous of them. And you look at Neil Gaiman's mythology, where gods only exist as long as you believe in them. As soon as you kill all the people that believe in them, the gods are dead. So if a god wants to go to war with another god, a meme wants to battle another meme, they kill each other, and, you know, one meme lives, the other one dies. One god gets stronger, and the other one fades into forgotten history.
Are you using a meme like it's got an original definition or something?
Well, I'm using, like, the Dawkins definition. Yeah.
How dare you?
Well, that's the definition of meme. Like, that's...
It was.
It's the same definition we use as a joke. Like, little small ideas, all of them are now just compacted into images. And it's the same thing. It's ideas that are transferred from mind to mind, spread like viruses.
Well, going back to how we started the podcast, you know, how reading these five books has affected us, I kind of knew going in that I was going to view it kind of darkly. And I kind of feel like I'm walking the middle line by saying I did see some positive things in it and some negative aspects.
Oh, yeah.
About, you know, God being this angry thing. But ultimately, I kind of got the impression that in order for a balanced system, you got to focus on the rewards, but possibly more importantly, the risk. And that goes, I think, through anything you do, whether it's driving a motorcycle, experimenting with mind-altering substances, getting involved in a religion. You know, you can focus on the rewards, but there are risks too, and those help motivate your action.
And not just the risks that come from the doing, but the risks that come from the not doing.
Yeah, don't let the risks inhibit you from doing the thing.
But yeah, and that's something that they lay out very clearly, that if you don't do the thing, there will be bad things that happen. And man, like, that's such an important lesson to figure out and absorb, that, like, while you could do things and bad things might happen, if you just stay in the same spot, like, you lose even more because you don't allow yourself to experience what you don't know you don't know.
Yeah. It's not what you don't know. It's what you think you know that just ain't so. Mark Twain.
I think that's a pretty good place for me to call it for this podcast, personally, unless there's some sort of crazy other pressing debate topic you want to get into. I think we could do a wave cast next week, maybe, on that one.
Yeah, I think I got everything I wanted to say out. There's some more strength of a unicorn stuff that comes up, too, in this chapter. So, you know, just random point.
Unicorns or bison or something.
Yeah, oryx, rhinoceros. It's impossible to know for sure, but
there was probably never anything other than a narwhal with one horn.
There was actually also another point related to that. When I was reading Caesar in the Gallic Wars, he talks about unicorns, how, like, the Gallic people were selling unicorn horn. And, like, he basically describes a narwhal horn, and the people that he was talking about were, like, off the coast, that's where all the narwhal were. So,
What
yeah.
age did you guys like? Were you guys ever? I know Matt, you said you were in the church as a kid,
Matt's not here.
Rugmo. Were you ever like,
I'm Will.
I'm sorry, Will, you were in the church as a kid, Rugmo. Were you ever like part of the church community or anything?
I've never been a part of a church community, and I remember that the first time I felt the impulse to call myself an atheist was the first time someone tried to tell me that Noah's Ark actually happened. So that's my history.
Do you think it didn't happen, dude?
Oh, jeez. I think there was probably some floods, but I don't think he saved every single living species on a boat.
Then how come we still have all of
Because the flood wasn't that
them?
big. You know, they say they flooded the world. What was the world to them? It was the known universe. Like when we describe the known universe, we don't talk about everything
I
that there
baited you
is.
hard.
We
I
talk
baited you
about.
so hard.
I know, but these are like the kind of things that get me going, dude. You know how to
So
push my
easy.
buttons.
Will, what age were you when you left being in the church?
I can't say for sure. Things get a little vague between the ages of maybe 11 and 15. You know, I definitely wasn't ever sold on the church, but like I went because that's what we did, but we didn't go all the time. And like I did Sunday school for a minute. I barely remember it. And then my family dynamic got weird. We had a couple of my nephews came into the fold. So I became an uncle when I was like 7. And so by the time I was 13, we had children in the house again. And so we were going back to church and bringing them to Sunday school, because it was a good community. And I remember around that time, they tried to get me into the youth group, and the youth group was comprised of like four people that were 5 or 6 years older than me. And that was when I knew that this was not the place that I was trying to find my community. So,
Yeah, I think around the
probably, probably,
same time I left.
probably like just before high school, I think. But it was petering. There's another term for a
We
while.
went, our family went quite often because my dad and grandfather were deacons in the church. And so we would go like Sunday school and then church after that and a Wednesday night service. But there was something always that, I don't know, I felt uneasy about. And it wasn't until rereading the Bible that I kind of had that retrospective analysis of, okay, now I know why I felt uneasy. But back when I was a kid, I actually started getting like physically sick thinking about going to church, the I don't want to go. And once I actually puked in church, and it was kind of that I realized, maybe I shouldn't go back. I don't know what
Yeah,
it is. It was probably just a stomach bug.
skin might start burning on your next visit.
Seriously.
Yeah, my only real experience with like the church is from like grandparents. Like my one grandmother was like hands down the most influential person in my life, but she was like a devout Roman Catholic, but never went to church because she was like completely blind, like fairly disabled, like up there in the years, couldn't really leave home for anything. So needed a lot of taking care of, so there's never really any church going in my childhood, but it wasn't excluded from my childhood, I should say.
Yeah, I was always raised with this idea that if we didn't have these laws handed down by the alleged God, that we would just be a lawless species.
Which is so ignorant of a concept to try and instill in humans. Because if you think about it for 15 seconds, you'll realize with or without structures of laws, there will always be people that want to bend reality to their will and are willing to do whatever it takes to do that. And boom, you've got laws, whether that's mob rule or otherwise.
The will to power is real, man. As much as we don't want to believe it, Nietzsche was right.
Yeah.
Any closing remarks, fellas?
Are you along for the ride all the way through to the end of the New Testament with us, Synapsion?
Yeah, I think so.
Heck yeah, we should probably invite you back to
Excellent.
the full-time server. That's definitely all for now, though.
Yeah, Pat's not here today. He'll be back in our next recording on Friedrich Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil, which you've been hearing us reference in every video for the past month or so.
Month. Check us out at bookbabe.club. Like, comment, subscribe. Send us your money.
Yeah, follow us on Anchor, Spotify, YouTube, all the places you get your
Apple
podcasts.
Podcast.
Yeah. And may the
Don't
force be
piss
with you.
off CI in the pyramid.
Yeah. Yeah. Praise God. May the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.